Hello everyone, Jamie here, and thank you for tuning in to this last episode of SFN Shorts, where I conducted interviews with researchers at the Society for Neuroscience Conference last November in 2023. We will be back next week with a full-length episode, and after that we will be returning to monthly content. But don't worry, if you like SFN Shorts, I'll be traveling to many different conferences this year and will be posting similar content on the Patreon, so stay tuned for that. And without further ado, let's get to the episode. Our first interview for this episode features Simon Ogundare, an undergraduate student at Columbia College. He was part of a team of researchers developing new ways to measure and track mice's behavior responses during testing, specifically pain testing, in a laboratory setting. So yeah, can you just start by introducing yourself?
Yeah, definitely. So I'm Simon Ogundare. I'm a senior at Columbia College. I'm an undergrad in the Abdu-Sabor lab, and we study touch and pain, kind of pleasurable touch as well as like chronic pain.
Cool. Yeah, that's awesome. That's similar to what I study, so I'm really interested in this. So can you tell me a bit about what you've developed here?
Yeah, absolutely. So this has been a work, many people have like contributed to this, and it's been a work in progress for a little while, but the tool itself is called PAWS. It's a tool which allows us to assess kind of pain-related behaviors, not only at kind of the reflexive or maybe like spinal cord level, but also at like the affective or like brain-driven level. And it's something that I think is, you know, a little like needed for the field, just because with more like binary assays that look at, you know, withdrawal versus no withdrawal, sometimes we lack a bit of like behavioral specificity or like resolution for what is actually going on in like the animals. How are they processing the pain in like their brains? And the tool itself is really just a like a kinematic, like a motion analysis pipeline. So it'll look at a lot of aspects about how mice maybe move their paws in the air kind of naturalistically in response to a variety of stimuli. And we're able to kind of get a sense of like how they react and see whether there are differences or like similarities in different like pain models and things like that.
So it's like, what components does it involve? Like, what do you need in order to do this?
Yeah, definitely.
So really all we need is a camera. So we've been doing a lot of work. We record at high speed, we use high speed videography, which is all to say that we record videos in slow motion. We have our videos at like 2000 frames per second typically, because these responses are insanely quick. They're maybe like 0.1 seconds. And because of that, it's so necessary to be able to like resolve all the differences in their behavior. We kind of need to have access to that like sub-second scale. So typically we'll have a camera that's kind of like side-on recording an animal for that purpose. And we'll also need a set of stimuli. So usually we'll stick with things that are non-painful and then some things that are painful. Typically those are like more static things. So like a cotton swab or like a, I forget what it's called, like an eyeshadow brush. And then more like kind of like noxious stimuli, like a pinprick. And we're able to kind of essentially just stimulate the paw and record how they move in the air and get a sense of like, what is going on? Like, how does that give us any indication into what's going on in like the mind of the animal?
I guess like, so have you demonstrated what kinds of things, I guess, can you capture with this that you can't just capture with a binary withdrawal?
Totally. So I can speak pretty broadly towards pain research. I mean, from my understanding, it's hard to fund it, I think, because one, it's pain research. And two, I think sometimes when you're developing drugs, it's so hard for them to effectively translate.
Right.
Even though mice are, I would say like evolutionarily like closer to humans than maybe other organisms, there's still a lot of things that they can't like tell us, right? Lots of things that we can't hear. So I think especially when it comes to like drug development, like it's important to get a sense of like, you know, what is like the entire like, I guess, sphere of behaviors that we're like looking for. And that's something that I think PAWS can at least teach us a little bit more about than other tools. I would say like with the like withdrawal, like do they withdraw their paw, do they not? We're really getting a sense of, is say like pain being killed? Is this gonna be an effective painkiller? But something that maybe we lack a bit of resolution for is, okay, well, what else is going on, right? It kills pain and what, right?
Okay, yeah.
So using this tool, it's something that we've used in the past to kind of evaluate, like say drugs, and get a sense of at the behavioral level, maybe they're, you know, as we're kind of seeing in this poster, and I guess to like describe, like there are particular areas that like their responses can inhabit. And this is like, to describe it, it's a bit of like an abstract, like pain to touch, like subspace. And in order to have like a physical, like visualization of, okay, where are these mice going? Like with drug, without drug, like that could give hopefully like a good idea of maybe what's going on and what's making maybe a drug particularly hard to translate beyond the fact that, you know, it kills pain or it doesn't.
Right. You were saying earlier, which I thought was a really interesting observation, is that in you were talking about, I think, a particular drug that didn't translate very well in people, that like when you administered it to these mice, they like didn't have, they weren't inhabiting the like pain abstract space, but they were inhabiting like some weird other space that wasn't like not pain either.
Yeah. And there, I think like there's a lot of, there's a big role that I think like these methods can take in terms of like learning those things. I mean, we use PAWS in addition to like some other tools in that paper. And I think from my understanding, we found that, yeah, the space that the mice kind of inhabited was not like a pre-pain state. It was kind of something different to that. So I think, you know, methods like this and PAWS, I think, are important. I think it gives us a sense of maybe like it's not getting us directly to like the answers that we want of like, does this drug translate or not? But I think it gets us a little closer.
But you can better identify drugs that might translate.
Yeah, I think so. And I think the fact also that it's like, I mean, it's, we've been developing it in the lab. It's like completely open source and like anyone can use it, like contribute to it. I think that's also played a role because, I mean, it's been incredible, like a great kind of project, lots of fun.
That is really awesome.
Thank you.
Our next interview features Nita Karam, a researcher at Neurosense Therapeutics. His research focuses on studying new biomarkers for a neurodegenerative disease called ALS or Lou Gehrig's disease, and also studying new drug combinations to treat this disease. So if you could just start out by introducing yourself.
Yeah, so my name is Nitai Karam. I work at Neurosense Therapeutics. We're a drug development biotech company working on developing combination therapy for neurodegenerative diseases. So mainly ALS, as I'm going to present in the poster, but we also have an Alzheimer's pipeline and a Parkinson's disease pipeline. So basically, ALS is still a highly unmet need. And today we only have approved monotherapies, and they're not sufficient. And due to the complexity and the heterogeneity of the disease, we figured that a combination therapy would be more adequate. The first challenge would be to find these drugs that we're going to combine. So we came to a conclusion that these two FDA-approved drugs are the right ones for us. Celecoxib, which is a COX-2 inhibitor, it's an NSAID. And ciprofloxacin, which is an antibiotic from the fluoroquinolone family. The first challenge is pharmacokinetics and pharmacodynamics. We had a rodent study in which we gave mice either an injection of ciprofloxacin or a combination of ciprofloxacin and celecoxib, which is our IP. We call it Prime C. And we saw that when we gave them the combination, the concentration of ciprofloxacin in the mouse brain was significantly elevated compared to ciprofloxacin alone. So this was promising, led us to a human pharmacokinetic study, which also showed synergism between the two drugs.
So they kind of help each other get into the brain somehow.
Yeah.
Can I quickly back up and ask, so like, why did you choose an antibiotic and like NSAID to treat ALS? Like, what's the rationale there?
So a lot of literature reviews. The field today is looking at repurposed drugs a lot of times. And a lot of times you might find drugs that are adequate for a specific disease to be adequate also for another one. So it's mostly like very vast literature review. And at a certain point, we just said, why not try it?
Yeah.
So the second challenge was efficacy. We wanted to see if our combination drug really helped cell survival. So what we did is, in collaboration with Dr. Justin Ichida's lab at USC, we got this iPSC model. from ALS patients. We looked at motor neurons and treated them with either Prime-C combination or each of its comprising compounds. And we compared them also to control cells treated with a vehicle and ALS cells treated with a vehicle. And what we see here in purple is the survival curve of the Prime-C treated cells. They survived as well as the control cells, yeah, which was really, really promising. This was significantly higher than each of the comprising compounds alone and ALS control vehicle. So this was very promising. In another non-sponsored study by Dr. Ichida's lab at USC, he compared different compounds for treating ALS.
Okay.
And it showed that both approved and investigational, and it showed that our Prime-C combination performed among the best as to hazard ratio, which means that the lower the hazard ratio, the less the cells die.
Okay.
So that's what our combination showed.
And just to kind of back up, so the cells you're testing this in, they're taken from patients, and then you make them become neurons. And
right.
Yeah, and then you test like how... Are there any other cells in the dish, or is it just these neurons in the dish?
It's just these cells. It's iPSC-derived motor neurons from ALS patients.
Okay.
Following this, we did a preclinical study on two zebrafish models, which showed really nice results, both in locomotor activity and morphology. And that led us to get a 505(b)(2) from the FDA.
What does that mean?
So it's kind of like a fast approval, not approval, a fast like permission to keep going into clinical trials,
okay.
Especially
yes.
For orphan drugs like in the case for ALS.
Okay.
So our first clinical study in ALS patients was a phase 2A proof of concept study. We checked on 15 ALS patients throughout 12 months if our Prime-C combination really helps them or not. So the drug was well tolerated, no severe adverse events. And we put forth as primary endpoints biomarkers because we also want an objective measurement to how well our drug is doing. So we saw that levels of TDP-43 protein and prostaglandin 2, which is a biomarker implicated in neuroinflammation, they were both reduced throughout time in these patients. As well as clinical outcomes, which were respiratory outcomes, ALSFRSR, and forced vital capacity, which showed a halting of deterioration of these patients.
Okay.
So this was super promising, and that led us to Paradigm, which is our current phase 2B clinical trial. It's multinational from a few sites. 69 patients received our Prime-C combination in a 2-to-1 ratio, which means that for every two patients that receive the drug, one patient received a placebo. And we just finished this phase of the study. We just finished the 6 months double-blind phase. 96% of the patients chose to move on to the open label extension, which means that for another 12 months, they're going to receive the drug, all of them. A lot of people are talking about biomarkers as the next thing, as an objective measure, not a clinical measure. Clinical in the terms of like, you know, respiratory tests or stuff like that, or questionnaires. So we're really putting our foot down in this matter and putting TDP-43 and prostaglandin 2 biomarkers as primary endpoints for our study, which is brave, but we're optimistic. Our secondary efficacy outcomes are the respiratory outcomes and the questionnaires. So we're crossing our fingers to get a clinical readout in a few weeks and crossing our fingers that it'll be positive.
Right, yeah.
By the way, I didn't mention we're taking the measurements via plasma and not some invasive CSF type of measurement, which is very important to our patients. So in this part of the study, we're collaborating with many companies, many academic labs. We work with Biogen on neurofilament light biomarker as an exploratory endpoint. Neurofilament light is a biomarker for neurodegeneration. We're looking at microRNAs with Professor Noam Shomron from Tel Aviv University. And in general, we just want to learn more about the disease. We want to learn more about what our patients and what they need, and actually our combination therapy's mode of action, because that'll also help us understand the disease better. So we're very open to new collaborations. We're looking forward for our readout and for our phase 3. Yeah, and also for other pipeline, other indications down the pipeline, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's.
And so I had a question about the patients you're recruiting. Do these patients have a particular subtype of ALS or just like all ALS patients?
Right, so we do have strict inclusion criteria. We have both bulbar and non-bulbar site of onset patients. We have C9 patients and we have sporadic patients. Most of them are obviously sporadic. Most of them are not bulbar. But once we get the readout, we're gonna stratify by that and look at subgroups, subgroup analysis by that, because obviously it's very important.
Yeah, thank you so much. Thank you for agreeing to be recorded for this.
Yeah.
Our final interview features Dr. Siwan Rao, a assistant professor at Binghamton University. She is part of a research group studying glaucoma, investigating new ways to study glaucoma in mice and new ways to detect glaucoma early in humans.
So, but first, can you introduce yourself?
Okay, my name is Siyuan Rao. I'm an assistant professor in biomedical engineering department in Binghamton University. But today I'm representing Dr. Chenming Wang to introduce a glaucoma project.
Awesome. And so can you tell me a bit about the project?
Sure. Dr. Chenming Wang's research program generally have three directions. The first one is creating the experimental glaucoma model using new materials, viscous materials. The second part is develop a non-invasive ERG recording system to find more sensitive biomarkers in electro recording signals, which can help for the next generation early to detect the early stage glaucoma in humans. The third part is to develop the gene delivery, gene therapy for treat or have the genetic intervention for glaucoma neurodegeneration. So I'm going to introduce a little bit in detail in these three directions. So generally we are engineering lab, so we are interested in developing new tools, apply new materials to study the nervous system. So this part, we develop a viscous bead, has a hybrid system, has a soft surface with a hard core. And by one dose injection of the viscous bead, we can create a chronic high IOP situation in mouse. This gives us opportunity to have a longer window to study the glaucomatous neuron degeneration in mice. So using those models, it can help us to create a reliable test.
Basically, to kind of summarize, like this is inducing glaucoma in these mice.
Yes.
Okay. And can you, because this is for like a very layperson audience, can you briefly go over like what glaucoma is and like why it's so important to study it?
Okay. First, glaucoma represents the disease of neuron death in the eye. It triggers the blindness and it affects a lot of population. The most important part is irreversible. So before, as soon as we find it's neuron already died in the eye, we cannot really rescue them. So that is important to find the following, we describe in the following project, have the early access before we find the pathological death. And using those straightforward and engineering approach to create the experimental glaucoma model in animal, we can mimic or capture the feature of human glaucoma. That can help us to study the glaucoma. The second one is actually using electroengineering approach to detect some signal from the muscle, like above the eye, and using that signal to dig into the deep structure, which population of cells contribute that component of signal. So right now the ERG recording is a mixture of all the signal come from different type of neuron cells from the eye. Using our algorithm, we are able to dissect the complex signal and identify the, here we identify a high frequency component, OPs, which is contribute to the more contributed from the RGC cells from the deep structure of the eye. So without really distracting the tissues, we are able to non-invasively understand, get to know the information, which cells get affected. So that gives us access to in the early stage. So we can actually compare those two parts. Before we see the cell death in tissues, we find the OP signals already changed in early stage of glaucoma. So we hope to apply, of course, after more careful validation, we hope to have a better algorithm which can actually apply to human ERG recordings.
Okay, so you can, this recording, like, it doesn't it require any implants in the eye, it just records from the outside.
Just on the surface.
Okay, and you're still able to, and so these signals that you're recording from are from, like, the cells that are responsible for, like, vision.
Yes, the light stimulation. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, and then you can use this in the, like, in the future in people to be able to see, like, catch glaucoma early, yes, and then potentially do some kind of interventions that can preserve people's sight.
Yes, so the earlier the better. And the third part is more related to the gene therapy. We are hoping to using AAV virus, adeno-associated virus vector, carry that piece of gene which we identified has a neuron protective function directly into a specific population of cells in the eye. So Dr. Wang is combining some chemistry and also ultrasound technique. So have some quantum dots, which is a Nobel Prize technique this year, conjugate on the surface of AAV virus, and using those very bright fluorescent dots can visualize where the virus goes, and that can give us understanding where the gene gets delivered to which population of cells. And we already identified a pool of candidate genes which might have the neuron protection functions. Now we are using this technique to screen the neuron protective or more adverse effect. Yeah. So hopefully combine all those tools together, we can provide a better engineering technology for vision neuron degeneration treatment.
That's really great work. Thank you for going through all that with me.
Thank you all for tuning in to this last episode of SFN Shorts. Once again, this episode has featured interviews with Simon Ogundare, Nitai Karam, and Siwan Rao. You can follow along with their posters on the website, as well as find previous episodes of SFN Shorts. Our music is by Sam Brunwasser. You can find more of his work at soundcloud.com/visualsnowbeats. As always, you can download the paper and read the transcriptions at inplainenglishpod.org. And make sure to follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at Plain English Sci. That's PlainEnglishSci. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you next time for another episode of In Plain English.